This is the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore. On this episode, we'll hear from presidential historian David Petruggia on the last years of Theodore Roosevelt's life. We'll hear about the life of an inspiring drama teacher in Amsterdam, New York, Bert DeRose. And we begin and will end with more stories from Cycling the Erie Canal, A Path Through History, an audio tour of Montgomery County designed to be used by bicycle riders in the county's Erie Canal Way bike path, which runs from St. Johnsville to Amsterdam. The vignettes for this audio tour were compiled and edited by Montgomery County, New York historian Kelly Iacobucci Farquhar. The stories are on a free app that can be downloaded to smartphones. To download the app, which is called Travel Stories, visit Google Play or the Apple Store. Travel Stories is a Wyoming-based company that produces GPS-triggered audio vignettes for travelers. Each narration will automatically play when you enter the story's geographical area. The Palatine Church, Saved by Loyalists. As you enter the heart of the Mohawk Valley, you'll see the Palatine Church, which is one of the oldest churches in the area. Lutheran Palatine Germans built it in 1770, using limestone taken from a nearby creek. Legend has it that the Revolutionary War's Loyalist raiding parties spared the Palatine Church due to the fact that it was constructed by the Nellis family, some of whom were Loyalists, which meant British sympathizers, themselves. Three Nellis brothers landed in New York with the 1709 Palatine immigration. They settled in Stone Arabia on a 12,000-acre patent of land granted in 1723 to a group of 23 Palatine families. There, William Nellis contributed funds to construction of a log-framed Lutheran church. William Nellis and George Clock received a patent for a smaller tract of land in the vicinity of the present village of St. Johnsville and the hamlet of Palatine Church in 1754. This land grant was known as the Clock-Nellis Patent. Prominent families from the Stone Arabia Lutheran congregation, including the Wagner, Reber, and Hess families, contributed financially to construction of a second Lutheran church closer to the Mohawk River. William Nellis, particularly, funded the construction of the steeple adorning the church. It's one of the Mohawk Valley's most well-known landmarks. In spite of almost total destruction of the settlements during the raids in the late 1700s, at least two structures remain standing. The story goes a British officer who accompanied the raiding parties to the Mohawk Valley stopped the torches from lighting the Palatine Church. The officer had made a promise to his friend and colleague Henry Nellis to prevent any destruction to the church, as Nellis contemplated returning to his adjacent farm after the war. And now another story from Cycling the Erie Canal in the Mohawk Valley. Local forests returning to nature. The town of Charleston, the only town in Montgomery County that does not border the Mohawk River. What the town has is an abundance of forest land, including the Charleston State Forest and the Burbine Forest. The Charleston State Forest contains a large portion of what was called the Clark Lands. James Clark, the original grantee, had a three-life lease with the tenants on the land. But when that lease finally expired in the 1840s, his great-grandson raised the rent. This was during the height of the anti-rent wars, and many of the tenants not only abandoned the land, but also burned down the houses and barns they'd built rather than let Clark's great-grandson benefit from them. The town of Charleston lost over two-thirds of its population over the next 60 years. The 4,600 acres of the Charleston State Forest include much of this land, which went back to nature. It also includes the Warrior Trail, a path running north to south near the Waite Drive area that was said to be a major route for Mohawk Indians to access the Mohawk River. The Sarah Libb Gordon Road area was reportedly used as a Tory training ground during the Revolutionary War. Workers plowing a fire break in the area in the 1950s found a Revolutionary War-era sword in the ground, and it is still housed in the Museum of the Charleston Historical Society. The state forest is open year-round for fishing, mountain biking, hiking, hunting, camping, snowshoeing, and cross-country skiing and exploration. Located near the Charleston State Forest is the Thomas H. Burbine Memorial Forest and Nature Trail. The managed forest is dedicated to a hard-working Montgomery County employee that I had the pleasure to know. Tom Burbine was a county agent. He helped the farmers and others who were growing flowers or maybe crops on a personal basis. He did that for many years and was a frequent guest on the radio, and he died way too soon. The Burbine Forest, named for him, is approximately 330 acres and is maintained by Montgomery County. During the Great Depression, much abandoned farmland in this area reverted back to state ownership. These lands were reforested by the Civilian Conservation Corps and are now state forests. In 1930, Montgomery County purchased the piece of land that would become the Burbine Forest from the Fort Plain Bank to create a county forest. The forest contains numerous tree species, such as oaks, maples, and pines, ample wildlife, and a wetland. Wildlife includes deer and squirrels in the forest and turtles and bass in the pond. The Burbine Forest is an ideal location for bird watching. The maintained mile-long trail is a loop featuring trail signage and a 30-foot bridge over the pond spillway. On-site parking is available. These stories were from Cycling the Erie Canal, an audio tour compiled and edited by Kelly Yakabuchi Farquhar and produced by Montgomery County and the Fulton Montgomery Chamber of Commerce. Coming up, a conversation about Theodore Roosevelt with historian David Petrugia. The Historians Podcast depends on your contributions. We have a GoFundMe page this year. You can go online at GoFundMe.com and they'll take care of you. It's easy to donate online. If you'd rather donate by mail, make out a check to me, Bob Cudmore, and send it to Bob Cudmore, 125 Horseman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. And thank you very much. The Historians Podcast continues with presidential historian David Petrugia, author of the book TR's Last War, Theodore Roosevelt, The Great War, and a Journey of Triumph and Tragedy. David was interviewed on Historians Podcast, Episode 230, in August 30th of 2018. David, why did you write a book that only covers the end of President Theodore Roosevelt's life?
Well, because it's a story which is really not sufficiently covered, even though, I mean, he doesn't have the volume of books of a Lincoln, but it's pretty close, and there is a continuing fascination with him. And we all know what a whirlwind, what a hurricane, what a cyclone he is. And I think that leads to people doing his full biographies or even studying the latter years of his life really exhausted by the time you get to the point that I'm covering in the book. So, yes, there is the post-presidential period, and authors will talk about Africa or the Amazon or the 1912 election. But after that, they kind of drift away because they're like, man, I'm beat. I can't deal with this guy anymore. Yeah. But there's still really a couple of very good stories left. The story of his fight for American preparedness in World War One, in which Casey is right on the money. We are not prepared. When we go to war in April 1917, we have a standing army. We have the main army, not counting the National Guard, etc., of 85,000 men. Hmm. 85,000. We're drilling with broomsticks. We don't have planes or tanks or just about anything we need. So he had been right to argue for that. But is he arguing for it for the right reasons? Yes, in part because, yes, he was right. But also for the wrong reasons, because there is within the man a bloodlust. And it goes back a long way, at least until the 1890s. We can certainly document it till that. And he wants to go off and fight in that war. He wants to be, even though he's pushing 60 and overweight and sick from the Amazon and blind in one eye and deaf in one ear, and an ex-president, and not a particularly subordinate, even in the Spanish-American War. And that war was a vastly different war than what the trench war and the artillery-driven and barbed wire and machine gun-driven war of 1914-1918 is. He wants to go and fight in that war, and he confides to people he wants to go die in that war. And, of course, he also has to put the Republican Party back together again. Lincoln was the rail splitter, and Theodore Roosevelt in 1912 was the GOP splitter, giving the election to Woodrow Wilson with a minuscule 41% of the vote. He gets less of a percentage of the vote than Bryan does in getting creamed three times for the presidency. But when you've got not only a three-way split, but a four-way split with William Jennings or Eugene V. Debs in the mix, you can sneak in that way. And Roosevelt despises Woodrow Wilson. They had known each other early on in their life as reformers, as patrician intellectual reformers of the American political system, although working different sides of the partisan fence. And it's one of the things which I found very interesting was that one of the first people T.R. sees when he's president, when he rushes down to Buffalo to take the oath, is Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson is there. He's coming back from vacation in Canada. But they part because of not only partisanship, one, and not only because of their struggles over what we're going to do about World War One, but there's this thing called Panama. And when Woodrow Wilson proposes a treaty to give another, I think, $25 million to Colombia and to issue sort of an apology to Colombia for what happened back in 1903 and such with the coup engineered by TR's friends to hand over the canal zone to the United States, TR is just enraged. That is something he cannot ever forgive, because Panama is the great feather in his cap.
Hmm. Let me, and the risk of doing this in front of the historian, just kind of bring us up to a point and then ask you about what's going on at that point. I mean, it's widely known that Roosevelt, or TR, was president 1901 to 1909, decided not to run in 1908, but soon became disenchanted with his handpicked successor, William Howard Taft. And as you've been describing, in 1912, he split the Republican Party by running on the progressive or bull moose ticket against a Republican Taft, and Democrat Woodrow Wilson won the election. War breaks out in Europe, 1914, and he wants, you know, he's for preparedness by America. But we come to 1916, another presidential election year. Did Roosevelt try to run again in that year?
Yes, it's a very confused picture. And throughout his career, he's always saying, I'm through. You've heard the last of me. This is my last hurrah. goodbye, and he never means it. Right. Or, well, he probably does mean it, but he never carries through on it, including what you've just described, which right after he's elected president in 1904, he says, no, I'm not running in 1908, which was his greatest political blunder by far. Mm. So he's always saying no. And he has a famous statement early on in 1916, do not take me, i.e. do not take me for the presidency. The public should not, unless it is in a heroic mood. Mm. And what it means is he wants the presidency, he wants it on his terms. And he's not quite sure how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, the Republican Party, because his progressives are very progressive. They are very reform-minded. They hate the people who are running the GOP. The people who are running the GOP who remained loyal to Taft, and one of those figures is a future president, Warren Harding. It's interesting to see how they go from being at knife's point in 1910, 1912, to reconciling. And I have the feeling that had Harding lived, or had Theodore Roosevelt lived in 1920, that you would have seen a Roosevelt-Harding ticket. And then maybe you would have seen a Harding presidency, since there wasn't too much tread on the tire of Theodore Roosevelt. But he has to do it, and he has to do a tremendous dance, and it's not a particularly graceful dance at all. And what he does is, as he had done in running for the governorship of New York in 1900, what he does is he throws his reform, or in this case, progressive allies, overboard to make nice with the Republican Party. Now, conservative wing of the party that year doesn't have a lot of star power. In fact, Theodore has sort of sucked the air out of the whole GOP. I mean, he's such a dominant personality, even though he's been out of office now for 8 years. But he is the big man there, and he's going to shift his support eventually, very, very grudgingly, to another New Yorker, to a fellow who is upstate-born, Charles Evans Hughes. Mm-hmm. They're both reformers, but T.R., in part because of a controversy over an appointment of a state insurance commissioner when Hughes was governor, cannot stand Hughes. But it is a question of fire and ice, and Theodore Roosevelt is the fiery personality of all the presidents, and, well, okay, maybe with a current exception, mm-hmm. but the Charles Evans Hughes is ice. He's a very cold personality, and he's nicknamed the bearded iceberg. So their personalities do not mesh. And also, T.R. has tried anointing a predecessor once before in the shape of William Howard Taft, and that didn't work out too good.
No.
So it's like, I don't know if I want to try this again. But one thing he knows is he hates Woodrow Wilson. He hates him because of preparedness. I think he hates him because Wilson has stolen his progressive thunder. He hates him because of Columbia and the Panama Canal. Neither Theodore Roosevelt nor William Howard Taft was invited to the opening of the Panama Canal when Woodrow Wilson was president. You know, what's up with that? You know, so a lot of reasons to dislike Wilson, who he called a Byzantine logo thief. I'm not sure what that means, but he also called him a skunk, and I know what that means.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. That's David Petrugia on his book, TR's Last War. Theodore Roosevelt died January 6th of 1919 at his home on Long Island's Oyster Bay. He was 60 years old. The Great War had ended a little less than 2 months before his death. You're listening to the Historians Podcast, a story now about an inspiring teacher from my hometown of Amsterdam, New York. Longtime drama teacher and education administrator Bert DeRose contributed many Amsterdam memories to my Focus on History column in the Daily Gazette, over the past 20 years. DeRose died November 28th at age 87. When he was six, his family, living on River Street on Amsterdam's South Side, had to flee their home in February 1938 during a Mohawk River flood. When the water subsided, DeRose enjoyed playing on the chunks of ice left in his backyard. He said, "That was as close as I ever got to Alaska." His uncle, Ralph Pagliaro, was the last Amsterdam soldier to die in World War I. Pagliaro, a native of Italy, was killed by a German sniper in Belgium 5 days before the armistice. The body was eventually returned to Amsterdam for burial. DeRose said, "My grandmother wore black for over 30 years." A longtime friend of Southside Alderman Angelo Susi Sardonia, who died in 1987, DeRose recalled that in one election campaign, Sardonia organized a kids' kettle band. The band featured young people banging on tin cans and buckets, drumming up votes for Sardonia. Bert DeRose's greatest impact in the community probably stemmed from the years he spent directing high school plays and an annual summer musical that he produced for 30 years for the city's recreation department. "I always tried to instill with the kids that no matter what they did for the theater, they were part of it," DeRose said in an interview in the year 2000 for a WMHT television documentary about the history of Amsterdam. "Forget about the star," he said. "Forget about the lead. There is no lead if the kid who's pulling the curtain pulls at the wrong time." Watching video of DeRose's productions, his actors convey emotional intensity. "What we did was study the script," DeRose said. "I went deep into the inner character of the character, the meaning of it all, the feeling at that moment. If you get the teenager, teenagers can do tremendous things." The larger community was involved in the spirit of the plays, according to DeRose. "Seeing their young people produce something," he said, "something for the kids to do in those days." He said Amsterdam had more than an average interest in show business. "I remember my grandfather telling me," he said, and he was an immigrant from Italy, "that they would bring in operas, Italian operas here, Polish groups, Irish, so I think it was that type of tradition." Future Amsterdam oratorio composer Maria Riccio Bryce accompanied other high school actors on the piano and also acted in DeRose's high school plays. She won the Amsterdam Thespian Society's Kirk Douglas Award for her role in West Side Story. Kirk Douglas, an Amsterdam native and friend of Maria's father, Peter Riccio, called to congratulate her. When DeRose decided to stage West Side Story, he said some people felt it was a bit tough for a high school to do. DeRose said, "We had a lot of fun with it. It came across very, very well. At times we had to be very careful during the rumble scene, and we had to cool them down a little bit." DeRose and his daughter, Michelle DeRose McShane, acted together shortly before his death in video segments used on Roku television episodes of a show called Kelly James and the Folk Review. McShane has followed in her father's dramatic footsteps and is also co-writer of a Western series being pitched to television networks. In the Roku show, McShane played Raven Rainbow, a middle-aged hippie, and DeRose played her father, Umberto. Umberto was his given name. You can watch some of these episodes on Facebook, and you haven't lived until you see Umberto DeRose do the tarantella. And now on the Historians Podcast, another story from Cycling the Erie Canal. It's about St. Kateri Tekakwitha. You may pronounce it differently. You may have the correct Mohawk pronunciation, but I'm going to go with Kateri Tekakwitha. If you'd like to talk about the pronunciation, you can send me an email at bobcudmore@yahoo.com. Just west of Fonda is a shrine dedicated to Kateri Tekakwitha, a young Mohawk woman who lived in the 17th century. On October 21, 2012, Kateri was canonized as the first Native American woman to be honored with sainthood. The story of her conversion to Roman Catholicism, Christianity, her courage in the face of suffering, and her extraordinary holiness is an inspiration to all Christians. The National Shrine was created to honor Kateri and the Native peoples north and south of the U.S.-Canada border. Kateri was born in 1656 to an Algonquin mother and a Mohawk chief in the Mohawk village of Osernenon, modern-day Auriesville, located on the south side of the Mohawk River. When she was only four, her parents and brother died of smallpox. Kateri survived the disease, but it left her face badly scarred and her eyesight impaired. Because of her poor vision, Kateri was named Tekakwitha, which means she who bumps into things. Kateri was taken in by her uncle, who was bitterly opposed to Christianity. When Kateri was 10 in 1666, a war party, French soldiers and hostile natives from Canada, destroyed Mohawk strongholds on the south bank of the Mohawk River, including Osernenon. The surviving Mohawks moved to the north side of the river and built their fortified village about half a mile west of the present village of Fonda. Kateri lived in Caughnawaga, site of the present shrine, for the next 10 years. At 18, she secretly began instruction in the Catholic faith. Her uncle finally relented, gave his consent for Kateri to become a Christian, providing she did not leave the Indian village. For joining the Catholic Church, Kateri was ridiculed and scorned by villagers. She was subjected to unfair accusations, and her life was threatened. Nearly 2 years after her baptism in St. Peter's Chapel at the present Kateri Shrine in Fonda, she escaped to the mission of St. Francis Xavier, a settlement of Christian natives in Canada. The village in Canada was also named Caughnawaga. Here she was known for her gentleness, kindness, and good humor. On Christmas Day, 1677, Kateri made her first Holy Communion, and on the Feast of the Annunciation in 1679, made a vow of perpetual virginity. Several people, including a priest who attended Kateri during her last illness, reported that Kateri had appeared to them and many others, and healing miracles were attributed to her. St. Kateri is the patroness of peace and ecology. This stories and others on this episode of Historians Podcast are from Cycling the Erie Canal, a path through history and audio tour of Montgomery County historic sites. The stories were compiled and edited by Montgomery County historian Kelly Iacobucci Farquhar. You've been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.